This episode of Podcats is brought to you by Jeff Civilico. Jeff has hosted 60-plus virtual events since March, ranging from corporate meetings to team-building workshops. Book Jeff at jeffcivilico.com. That's JeffCivilico.com. I am on the prowl indeed. Welcome to Podcats. This is Cats, John Katsalamidis of the Las Vegas Review Journal. My column is called Cats, fittingly enough. Find it on page 3A every day and online all the time. This is part 2 of a landmark episode of Podcats, number 100. We have collected a compilation of some of our favorite moments since debuting Podcats in November 2018. We resume the 100th celebration with a chat with Prince protege and background vocalist Elisa Fiorillo, who recalls singing Purple Rain on the day of his death. That night, I think it was that night. Didn't you sing Purple Rain that night?
I
or was
did.
It, the night?
it was out
with Lon over at the Lon Bronson band over
and
at
I
the Sunset
broke
Station.
Down because it was...
Why did you decide to perform? I know Lon asked you to sing that night, but why did you decide to sing so soon and that song? Because I don't think you'd ever sung it
I
solo.
I never sang the solo. I never sung the lyrics. I was sang the backgrounds. I felt like it would make me feel closer to him. And it did, because obviously after I sang it, I went in the lobby and I just broke down with Michelle Roll. She was there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was just floored. I just, he had done so much for me, for my family, for all of us. I mean, he came into my life when I really needed to work. Mm-hmm. He really validated me as a singer. Because in this town, I was like struggling trying to get work. The first person that hired me was Kelly Clinton.
Okay.
And,
and at the Sterling?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the Sterling.
Oh, wow.
And I had the baby wait, and she still hired me.
And you had your lucky tambourine that night,
I did.
Right? Is it from the tour?
Yes, I had my tambourine.
That was a soaring performance. It was really incredible.
Thank you.
It was surreal.
Well, it was outer body for me.
Trumpet great Brian Newman is Lady Gaga's friend and band leader. How did the two actually meet in New York in the first place?
What was your impression of her when you first met her?
She was just always, her and all the people that were, most of the people that we gravitated together to this scene at this St. Jerome's was, you know, a lot of friends of mine that are still, that are in the industry, that work for fashion or art or film or, you know, it was just kind of a melting pot of people that, what I liked most about that place is just like, it was the first time where I felt like, oh my God, I can do whatever I want. I can be myself. I can do, you know what I mean? Like, and she was doing the same thing. We were all doing that.
Yeah.
You know, we were doing the, you know, we were playing music as much as we could and then working to pay for our rent as much as we had to. You know what I mean?
Struggling artists.
Yeah.
I guess they call that, right?
And then drinking and partying in between.
Oh, and her the way she relates to you in Las Vegas, on stage and off, you know, seeing you guys together, it's obvious you're friends.
Oh.
It's clear that this isn't a real friendship that preceded anybody's
It's fun. She's a great musician, and we just have a good time doing what we do together, and you know what I mean? And it's like, we're simpatico? I don't know why you use it. Is that what you say?
Symbiotic.
Yeah, it's like you're just like, we don't have to say anything. Like I can tell if she wants something different, you know, or like I can tell if it's not right, and then I say, oh well, I give her another option, or we do, you know what I mean? But she's driving the bus, man. She's a killer queen.
Well, she's been very instrumental, as it were, so to speak, in the success of the residency in the first place by her just not only endorsing it and helping you make the deal, but showing up and being there.
That helps out a ton, and it's amazing when she comes down. I love to see, you know, like the fans' reaction, and I love just that camaraderie and that just kind of like it was when Sinatra was here, was there. was here. I thought we in Vegas were
he was here too.
Yeah, he was here too. But you know, Sinatra and like that. I felt like even when I hear stories about Las Vegas back in the day, and like even New York back in the day, you hear stories of like so and so dropping into her so and so's gig, and then even if they're not singing, they're hanging and they're playing, and they're just like
it's really become part of Las Vegas.
The amazing Jonathan was given 2 years to live several years ago. He announced his diagnosis of a serious heart condition in 2014, but the great magician and great prankster continues to live. Did he fake that diagnosis? And has he considered actually faking his own death?
A lot of people think that I was going to fake this whole thing, but this is the deal. I wanted to fake my death. I actually did want to fake my death, and I met with a team of lawyers to see what the...
When was this?
This was back when I lived in L.A. This was about 14 or 15 years ago. Because if you think about it, nobody's ever done it. Nobody's ever faked their death.
Not that we know
death. Of. No, right. Nobody's ever done it and come back. And Andy Kaufman and Elvis, but that's all bullshit, and nobody's really ever done it. And I wanted to be the first one to do it, disappear for, say, 5 years minimum, and then come back. And then, you know, show the whole process of what I had to do as a documentary, you know, where I had to go and how I had to deal with my bank accounts and who did I tell and who didn't I tell and who could I trust. You know, it would be a great documentary. And I'd be watching it in jail if they showed it. That's the deal. Because there's so many legal ramifications. Oh, my lawyers told me even the people associated with it would go to jail, you know? Oh, tax evasion. And people would sue for, distress and just a million charges that go along with it.
You investigated this.
I did. I had my lawyers and my management. We had an actual conference about it. And we decided that it was easier to actually die and have people place things around that make it look like you could still be alive. Like get people to think that I'm...
But really die.
But really die. And what if you did it? What if you did fake your death and you died? That would suck because you couldn't come back to go,
look. You would not wind up in prison.
Diamond David Lee Roth talks about how he keeps his energy up, his mid-level fury as he calls it, and recalls a famous conversation about furniture with David Bowie. Hey, I want to ask you something, by the way.
Hold on, I never answered the question.
Oh, go ahead.
That was
a
good riff, though.
That was a good riff. I got lost in the riff.
It's okay. Good one. Poetry, poetically. All right. I knew David Bowie. I'm going to drop a name. Okay. We shared strong drink on more than several occasions. And early 90s, 91, maybe 93, somewhere there, I was in a studio in New York. Phone call come through. Says, Bowie's on the phone. Let's talk to you. Hey, Dave, how are you? Good, David. He says, you want me to do it with the accent? I'll do it with Izzy.
We'll test drive. You can use it on stage if it works. Yeah.
It's a serious story. He says, David, I'm kind of in a quandary. He says, and I'm being serious. He says, I'm going to tell you something. Tell me what you think, but I tell you. And I took it serious. And I said, yeah, talk to me. He said, I bought furniture. And his life and music was never the same from that point.
He bought furniture. He just bought furniture.
First time in his life.
He purchased furniture in early 90s. First time.
Yep.
Wow.
First time. And it changed his life. It was significant, I think. If you ask me why that was such a quandary for him, because he was very serious. He was concerned. He was cutting the anchor chain.
Okay.
I have yet to buy furniture.
Now, I think two ways on this. Is it because you have there's somebody else out there handling furniture duties and you don't have
you're trying to steer it towards funny. I'm not being funny,
I'm struggling.
You are struggling.
That's right. I'm
serious. Very serious. It's symbolic. Mm-hmm. He had never put down an anchor, not romantically, not spiritually, not morally or musically anywhere. Very few people can live like that. There are only three kinds of people. Those who stay home, those who leave home, and those who go to sea. Mm-hmm. And David had put out to sea as a very young man. When he finally came to shore in New York City and got married, everything he knew ended.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I never bought furniture.
And you still haven't bought furniture?
That's correct. And that's what you see on stage. I'm not looking for a place to park. I'm driving around.
Ice Cream Social hosts and improv comedy greats Matt and Mattingly explain the art of improv comedy.
I first was in that.
Yes, so when
Flamingo.
So when Second City opened their training center here, I was like, finally, I can take improv classes in my town of choice instead of having to go to LA. I was flying out to LA on the weekends to take classes with UCB for a while.
Wow.
And you could do a $60 round trip to Burbank and back.
I've always been interested in what happens in an improv class exactly. I mean, can you really teach improv? I mean, that's
a scam.
It's like trying to coach speed or jumping ability. I think I expect it's inherent watching, but like, I've seen
it's
great.
It's no different than saying, can you go to a painting class or can you go to take tennis lessons? I mean, you know, you don't know what's going to happen in a tennis match, but you are given skills to attack any situation that happens, you know?
Yeah.
That's the same thing as an improv class.
The way I've always.
And right down to the white sneakers and all white shorts.
Yes.
And the cute skirt.
The way I've explained
and
it to
yelling
people
at the linesman.
Who are taking classes with me, I've always said that if you get serious about improvisation, you will come to a point where either a switch will flip. I felt like I was lucky enough to just kind of you see the Matrix, right?
Mm-hmm.
Either the switch flips and you go, oh, this is what you do, and it's not it's just you kind of get it, right?
Right.
Or you will keep going through classes and you will learn how to ape a competent improviser. You will be doing the things that lead to solid scenes, but you don't see
why.
You don't see the...
Okay.
Like, when you're... Like, you know, it's kind of that Michael Jordan throwing the basketball, the hoop is 18 feet wide.
You're kind of in a zone.
You get in a zone. And like, if you're in a long-form show... You see eight scenes ahead. You see eight scenes in the past, and your partners do too. It's really funky when that works out.
Harris headliner and America's Got Talent alum Tapeface does not speak on stage. He gives us the reasons why.
Why would you decide to develop a character that doesn't tap into that quality?
Because I'd already done so much of that previously, I'd felt like I was just going to be repeating the same thing. Mm-hmm. I think there's when people get comfortable, that's the problem. There's that David Bowie quote about, you know, when you want to step out into the water where your feet are just touching the bottom, and it's that moment where you're just out of your depth. That's when you create something really exciting and really fun. So for me, talking and doing comedy, that was me standing.
Even
on
though
beach.
Verbally you can explore many different ways to communicate.
Absolutely. Hmm. But also, and the other one was with the silent comedy. It was an area that no one else was doing at the time. In 2005, no one was really touching silent comedy. And also the word mime has such an evil connotation to it.
Yeah, so it's unfair too.
It's unfair. It really, really is.
So I've learned, over the years how difficult it is to be a mime.
Yeah.
It's not something you can just...
No, everyone thinks, oh, I'm walking against the wind. No, you're not. There's some incredible mimes out there. Stephen Banks as Billy the Mime is absolutely one of the greatest. Every physicality of his is just
on point.
Did
you have to train? Did you go to mime school?
I trained at a circus school.
Okay.
So before the move, this was like in 1998, 99 is when I did my circus training. So I majored in juggling. I minored in acrobatics, trapeze, high wire clowning, and mime. So that was my day for 2 years. So technically, I was supposed to be a juggler.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my original plan.
You'd be the most famous. But everybody's the second most famous juggler in the world to Penn Jillette.
I would happily challenge Penn to a juggle off at any time.
We
got to
do
wants.
That. We got to somewhere. Are you graded? How are you assessed in this atmosphere?
In circus school,
yeah.
We just had various. I don't know. We had to the first year. You did like an assessment on cabaret. You do a walkabout character. You do a school show. You do a street show. It was a New Zealand
pass or fail. Was it?
Yeah, it was. You can tell pretty quickly if you're going to fail when you're performing.
That's the grade.
So it's a pretty easy way to be graded. And then with like acrobatics and general other circus qualities, it's just like competencies. You have a competency level of this. And I think I was very lucky that I had such supportive parents. Like, technically, I dropped out of school to juggle.
How old were you?
I would have been 16 years
you
old.
And to juggle at age 16?
At age 16.
And your parents' response
was
positive to that?
My parents, they were pretty cool about it. I failed my school qualifications. I don't know what you call it over here. In New Zealand, we call it school cert.
Okay.
What do you call it in the UK? It's your GCSEs. What is your basic?
Your SAT.
Your basic.
Was it a high school equivalency?
High school. Your high school, okay. Your basic, yeah. Kind of, what's it? Yeah, I don't have any
of that. You
flunked
out of school.
I flunked school. Failed school. So, and they gave me the option. They said, and I was also homeschooled as well.
Okay.
So I flunked homeschool, which is impressive.
Where does one go to detention at homeschool? Where do they put you outside?
I think that's why my parents were so supportive. They were like, we don't want him for another year.
I don't care what he does. Get him out of here.
Get him out of this place. So they were really cool. So I had the option to either to do another year of study or to juggle. And at that point, I was more interested in juggling and street performing and that sort of thing. So,
being homeschooled, is that a way to become a more socially...
inept?
I was saying comfortable. Young man? Or
I think so.
Was there more to it than just the act of juggling?
I think there was more to it than the juggling side of things. I think you, as a performer, then when you move into performing communities, when I went to circus school, that was when I really met my community and met my people.
Carrot Top's first prop was actually a bell. His first audience was his grade school class.
And a ding, 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 ding. Come on, kids. We got to run to school. And then, but seriously, that's one of the very first moments you have to be in front of people and
got to use the thing.
Yeah, it was a prop.
Yeah,
it was a prop.
And they responded
bell,
to it.
And they did respond, yeah. But I got whacked with a ruler a couple of times too. Yeah,
at St. Mary's. But you were described in those days as a kid who didn't grow fast.
Eclectic. Oh, is that what they did? Mm-hmm. Didn't grow fast. That's it.
Smaller kid. Eclectic.
I was skinny and had freckles and red hair, and I hated it. So,
That was your formative years.
That was just yesterday. I hate it. I still hate it now. But yeah, now I can. Now it's green and purple and purple and orange and whatever.
Right. But you.
You're
performing. Instincts probably, I would think, were formed in those days. At your
You kind of wonder where it all came.
School.
You kind of wonder where it came from.
I wonder. Yeah.
Well, I do too. I was in the band. I played drums, and so that was another moment where you kind of look back and think where it all started from. So there had to have been some kind of thing that I wanted to perform, and of course, not being a comedian, but. I do a thing in the show where I talk about watching George Carlin and and Jonathan Winters and I would watch the Tonight Show when I was that. My mom would find me like, "What are you doing? I'm watching Jim Stafford, Stoddard and Snakes." Uh-huh. And I wanted
that's
to,
right,
yeah,
the novelty songs,
and
right?
I want to take,
uh-huh,
and
right.
I want to be that. I want to be that guy.
Carrot Top has done sellout business at Luxor, which has impressed his friend and longtime comedy headliner Jay Leno.
Are you still selling out? Are you still selling as much as you want to? How's your assessment of
your bankability out there? Yeah, we're lucky in a sense because the theater that we perform in is a nice size. So we're not trying to sell at the Coliseum every night at Caesars. So it's a nice size theater. We've been consistently, doing the same kind of in a sense number wise. So that helps us in a sense of brand. My audience gambles, they drink. That helps too.
They definitely.
So we have
drink.
A good demographic. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, though, we have a good. It's a good demographic.
No, mm-hmm.
But you know, it's funny going back to Jay Leno. He always says, whenever I see Jay, we've been friends forever, of course. He always says, "Hey, how many?" I say, "Oh, good. How many seats is the game?" And I always say, "Oh, like 5,600, 5,600. And then I always go, "No, Jay's like 500. He's like, "Oh, yeah." Every time I get him every time. And he always says, "Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, 5,000. That's a lot of seats." And I go, "No, it's 500. Oh, you say a lot of seats." Yeah.
He's still doing his ace.
Oh yeah, series. He's. Yeah. He's great. Jay's one. Of the, he's one of the nicest guys, and he's always, of course, been beyond great to me. One time, I love the story. We were going back. I did the Tonight Show that night, and I went into the dressing room. We were getting makeup, and I said, "Hey, Jay, I'm going to take your jet back to Vegas tonight, if you don't mind." And he goes, "Oh, that's funny. Yeah, you can go with me." And I said, "No, I'm just kidding." He said, "No, I'm going back. I'm going. I thought that the Marat at midnight was there with me."
So that night he was taking the jet.
Yeah. Okay. And I said, "Oh, I was just kidding." But anyway, so Jeff was with me. And so he says, "We're going to take the jet back." So we literally go to the airport and we're getting on his jet. I give him like $20 for gas money. I'm like,
only right.
Yeah, it's $20.
A parking voucher.
Yeah, it's a jet fuel. Here's $20. Here's my Southwest ticket and my free drink coupon if you want to use it. Whenever you, oh, yeah, and what's Southwest? What's Southwest Airlines? It's a thing. It's an airline. We're on the plane, and it's really bumpy. I mean, it was really one of those horrible nights. As we all know, living in Vegas, it's just, whoa. And he's sleeping. Jay's sleeping. He's out like a light. Jeff and I are on the plane. And I remember looking over at Jeff, and this is before all the – so I said, Jeff, I said, get the camera. I got to take a picture because Jay's head is like the size of – it's this big of – his head is huge. And he's just – he's sleeping. And we're like – we're just bouncing around every air pocket. And I'm like, Jeff, take a picture. I was like doing a joke. I was feeding him peanuts, you know, whatever. And all of a sudden, Jay wakes up like, hey, and looks over and he says, yeah, okay. I said, no. I'm like holding on to the arm. I was like, oh, I'm really not good. I'm really. Like, you don't like the term, man?
Chin Lim told me what he wants and what he doesn't want in his magic production at Mirage Theater. You're dedicated to this version of magic entirely,
totally.
Right?
I mean, so let's just hypothetically say if I had more control over this room in the future, or if I could not have to walk around props, then I would definitely have way bigger scale stuff. Yeah, I have a lot. I have a lot in my mind right now. It's just I can't do any of it because I can't touch.
Like props. A big crane, like giant saws.
Sure. No saws. No
strobes.
Boxes. No boxes. No saws.
And but pyro.
Maybe some pyro. But
I want to see Chin Lim with some pyro.
More
and
theatrical
cards.
Things, and I want it to be more of like an atmospheric experience rather than like, oh, here's a magic trick that will fool you.
Mm-hmm.
It's just gonna be like something magical rather than a fooling trick. That's kind of what I have in mind. But so far, I can't do any of that right now. But
it's interesting having, and maybe you agree with this too, having seen so much magic. I'm drawn to the more organic versions. I feel like after a while, you can look at a show and say, okay, that's something that you could maybe purchase
exactly.
or somebody's created
exactly.
elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take
and you and I have the same exact thoughts about magic. Then.
Yeah.
Yeah. I prefer organic too. Yeah. Uh-huh. Totally. I hate boxes, anything with a box or anything like that.
How's your line the last time I no boxes.
Yeah. I just can't do any of that. I want it to feel raw as well, like it unfiltered almost. Like I feel like sometimes maybe a lot of shows have this kind of like pizzazzle. Mm-hmm. And I like me and Colin have the exact same view on it. We made sure that it has none of that in the show. And we really want it to be as honest as possible, even though it's a magic show, which is strange because magic's all about lying and deception. Mm-hmm. We want to be as honest as possible. At the
professional
same time.
Liar. Styx frontman Tommy Shaw recalls the band's introduction to Las Vegas in the 1970s. This story involves Vegas icon Connie Stevens and the Aladdin Theater for the Performing Arts.
Well, I remember playing, I'm trying to think of this place, the first place we played, it might maybe the Sands or something like that. And this was a long time. This is in the mid to late 70s. And, they said that some singer had been singing Fooling Yourself the night before. I think it was Connie Stevens had sung Fooling Yourself in her act at the same casino that we were about to play.
I'll bet you it was the Aladdin Theater for the Performing Arts.
Yes, the Aladdin. That's what it was.
Connie Stevens was singing Fooling Yourself?
And I'd heard she had sung it on The Tonight Show.
Wow.
That was unforgettable. And it really seemed like, a place where she or Don Nichols or somebody like that would be performing. So it was very bizarre for us to be playing there. But anymore, it's not bizarre at all. It's kind of the standard, and to go there and do a residency. We did a brief one at the Venetian.
Yep.
And it was a blast. We were able to walk down there to the gig, play the gig, and then go walk to dinner afterwards, and it was pretty sweet.
John DiDomenico has portrayed Donald Trump since 2004. He remembers a bad private gig from 2019 when he was supposed to portray Trump and ran into a lot of delays.
This was not necessarily corporate, but it was in L.A.
In 2019.
Yeah, in 2019. And I was flying to L.A. to do a job below the airport. And El Segundo, is that right?
Okay.
Something like that. And it was a group of young people. They're in a very in the entertainment industry doing something specific in the entertainment industry. I'm not going to give anything away, but it's at a club. That's their holiday party. So it was probably this time last year. So I'm going to fly down. It's a 40-minute flight to LAX. So, but I book in a lot of time because I can get to the hotel, kind of relax. 6 hours late. Out of Vegas to LAX, changed planes twice, mechanical issues. Ooh. I was supposed to be on stage at 7 p.m. to do this bit as Trump. I don't even arrive, land in LAX till 9:30. They rush me to the hotel. I get into makeup. I come in. This group has been drinking for hours at this point. I walk in and I was ready to, you know, to kill, and they weren't having it.
Really?
They were not. They were not having Trump.
They didn't want to see Trump.
They didn't want to see Trump. They didn't. They were like, it was. It was not a. It was not a. It was not a. It was not the highlight of my career any means. But you know, the lesson is, and I you know, one of the things I really believe in is like maximum preparation. You know, Uta Hagen, you know, went to HB Studios in New York, like actor prepares, actor, be prepared, be prepared, be prepared, be prepared, and do as much as you can on the front end. Like having booked this flight, like hours and hours and hours, I did everything I thought I could do to make this thing work. But boy, when you come into a situation like that, it's hard to turn a crowd around.
Well, yeah. Would it have been different at 7?
Totally different.
Okay.
Yeah. They
and what did you, what
the
did
buy-in
you,
what did would have
you,
been different.
Okay. What did you come with when you realized this crowd was going
to
be?
I couldn't. I had to bail. They
really?
Were, yeah. They were not. They wouldn't quiet down. They were yelling. They were like throwing stuff. You know, like they were, there were props because they were, had like a photo booth thing. I was, you know, I'm like, it's like the shoe thing with George Bush. Really thing. Great to be here. Look at my moves. I'm so quick. So fast.
Plaza owner Jonathan Jossel was able to lure Oscar Goodman to the hotel's steakhouse with a little bit of flattery. But beef, booze, and broads is being phased out in the restaurant's title.
Dream to have a speakeasy.
Okay.
Somewhere in downtown when he came out of office. Well, when I realized that we didn't have a concept for the steakhouse, we said, well, you know what would be interesting? What if we went to Oscar and said, you want a steakhouse with a bar? And I didn't even have to say a word. I rocked up, met with Oscar, and all I had in my hand was a piece of paper with a picture of the dome from the outside, and it said Oscar's on the front. It just said his name in lights, in big neon lights overlooking the Fremont Street Fence. And he literally just said,
he liked
I'm
the look of his name in lights, did he?
His name in lights, that size. But it took a little while to, you know, really develop the concept. He loved the beef, brews, and broads after his old trial. We really did an agreement on a handshake. I mean, everything was a handshake with him. He's a man of his word. Everything he says, he's everything in the. This restaurant's 8 years old, if you can believe it.
Jeez.
And everything he ever said he was going to do, he's done.
Did they drop, or did you drop the beef, the booze and broads part of this in the formal title?
There you see it on the napkin.
Oh, there we are.
We dropped it formally from the title. We still use it in some marketing material because it is fun. But we don't have it on the front of the building. Right now, it's just Oscar's Steakhouse.
What was the reason behind that?
Well, I don't think there was one specific reason. I think some people just felt that it diminished the brand. Some people, I shouldn't say incredibly, but people did find it offensive, the terminology broads. And
not to mention cows.
And we
the
just
beef
sort
part.
Of, we just sort of felt like Steakhouse was a bit more in line with the brand.
Uh-huh.
And we still like to have fun here. We still like to, you know, keep it in line with Oscar's brand, but the beef, brews, and broads just was a little of a gimmicky.
Frank Marino has been a strip headliner for 35 years in Evening at La Cage at the Riviera and later Divas Las Vegas at Link Hotel. He's now in Legends at the Trop. How does he like it?
I kind of like this a lot. And I wasn't sure if I wouldn't like being an employee, being, you know, my own boss for all those years.
You're talking about the Legend show.
Yes, but I got to be honest, I love it. I love not having to worry about 35 people. I was like the little old lady lived in the shoe. Mm-hmm. One of my kids got a scraped knee. The other one forgot their wig at home. And I could never just really concentrate on what I wanted to do, which was entertain. I would have never even thought of producing had I not had a 25-year-old show, Close La Cage at the Riviera, and we were all left outside. I wanted to come back. So
that's when you became the head of the whole operation. Yes. Was at that point. Because when you started, you were an employee.
I was an employee.
You were a well-paid employee.
And a you very were a well-paid
star employee.
Right,
but you
right,
were,
right. And a very highly publicized contract, mm-hmm. Because back then you made a lot of money.
Yeah. You were at the Riviera, which was a river of molten gold in the 80s.
Yes,
yeah.
And people would make fun of it. I'd be like, this show made me a millionaire. I don't,
I think people don't realize, as I talk to you, I'm reminded of it, what the Riviera was at the time you performed there.
It was amazing.
It was happening. I mean, mm-hmm. it was almost a jewel of the strip.
It was the first hotel, I believe, to have two shows in it. They had the Splash Show, mm-hmm. and La Cage was the first one, and it went as the second. Now you go, every hotel in Vegas has 7 or 8 shows. It's mm-hmm. like, if there's a closet, there's a show in it.
The Mirage, I was just writing about the Mirage. It has 7 yes. shows. You just said it. But it had 2 hit shows that were packed all the time. You couldn't do enough shows. Right. You were doing like 15 a week or something,
weren't
you?
We did. Okay. So we did 3 shows a night. And then it went to 6 nights a week. Then it went to 3 shows a night, 7 nights a
21
week.
21 performances of Diva, of a La
week.
Cage.
No day off.
Wow.
We could thank the Rat Pack for that because they used to do these 3 little mini shows. And I was like, oh, my gosh. So.
Yeah, their shows were a lot shorter.
Yes.
Lorena Perel's life is like a movie, or maybe it's like 2 movies. The fantasy singer came from humble beginnings, to say the least, in San Francisco.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was my all-time favorite anthem. Yeah.
You're from San Francisco.
Born and raised.
And how did you get to Las Vegas in the first place? Tell us that odyssey.
Oh, man. Ooh, it's like a movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Selena. No. It's more like Maine and Manhattan, but graduated from high school. My mother comes from Mexico. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we make the jokes. But
you make the
I got papers. Born in San Francisco.
How many Latinas in the crowd? I have papers.
I make great tacos. But I graduated from high school, followed my mother's footsteps. She's always been a housekeeper. She mm-hmm. worked her butt off, taking good care of us. And so did my dad. And I thought I just would do what she did and made more money than working in a mall, honestly. Mm-hmm. So I'd worked 9 to 5.
Where did your mother work?
She worked when I was a baby, she worked in like a factory, mm-hmm. dry cleaning, kind of folding
right.
the whole, all these sheets in the hot, atmosphere, sweating, busting her butt off.
Labor.
Yeah. And then she met my dad, my stepdad, who's my father. Amazing. They both worked their butts off just to support us. But when out of high school, I decided to join her in the workforce at the nursing home she was cleaning at. So
okay.
it was a convalescent home.
Right.
That's where I started singing on the side upstairs for the elderly, and it was really
those are your first audiences, right?
Yeah, first time. Crazy. Hey, how much is that doggy in the window? And the lady went whoop whoop. It was just that's all I knew. I never thought I'd be this. So
whole different story
yeah.
there than
so
here.
So I used to clean, rooms. I did it from 7 a.m. to 3:30. Yes. Mm-hmm. Now it's the opposite.
Right.
I did it for about 5 years. And then after that, I worked in the financial district. I had the whole business suit. Uh-huh. I know, right? Crazy. Answered phone calls. They had transferred.
It is made in Manhattan.
Huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ish.
I did that. And I was content. I was happy. I didn't know any difference until I went on vacation, which most people know this story. I went on vacation on a cruise ship
mm-hmm.
with my parents and entered a talent show.
On the cruise ship.
Yes. Next thing you know, it's history. I get a tap on my shoulder. Cruise director offered me a job pretty much 6 months later.
Get on that cruise.
On that cruise.
What
but
did you
I don't,
sing?
I didn't do that shit. But
okay. What did you sing when you did the talent contest? Do you remember the songs?
I did a couple of songs. I did Crazy. Of course, I love mm-hmm. Patsy Cline. Crazy, Natural Woman.
Oh, okay. Another
and
one.
And Chain yeah. of Fools.
Wow.
Yeah. That got me the big one. Crazy was fun until like, I was over
singing. Did you have
singing.
The bug right when you sang, right when you started singing in front of people? Did you have the bug? People talk about that.
No, I was shy. Really? I swear. Mm-hmm. I just had a couple of glasses of wine in, but that helped. My mom's like, Mija, go. So I had, wasn't shy at the time. And then next thing you know, I was ready to go back home to my office job, which mm-hmm. I was very happy at. I was good at it. Filing, mm-hmm. if you ever need one.
It was like an office,
manager. Or office assistant. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did a lot of filing.
I see you in the Transamerica building. Why is that?
Yeah.
Is that where it was?
It was actually, I used to drop off packages. I was a little messenger on the side too.
Yeah, I see you walking around.
Yeah. I was just, doing the bar thing and, you know, my briefcase, and it was just Market a district, totally, it was financial district. It was 101 California Street.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. You're right in the middle.
Yeah, I was right there. Uh-huh. And, but when I did the cruise ship thing, I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Chumlee of Pawn Stars was not in the show's original concept. Why not?
Understood. I was wondering if they were going to be smart enough to add me in as a cast member.
I wasn't, right?
Well, no, they never even had filmed me at that point.
Okay.
They filmed the pilot, or they filmed the sizzle reel. It was Rick, Corey, and the old man. It was just like an introduction to us.
Mm-hmm.
So then they came in, they were like, okay, we'll film the pilot. Well, I guess at the pilot, it hadn't really been picked up yet, but the History Channel said, hey, we're very interested in it. Here's some money for one 15-minute episode or one 30-minute episode, whatever it was. We made a small episode.
Okay.
And they did use me in it, and they tried using, I think we had about 12 employees at the time, and they went through everybody to see, all right, who's going to be our fourth member. And I didn't watch much TV, but I decided I should go watch some TV, some reality show. And
oh, did you? Do some research?
Yeah, I just kind of realized what they were missing is, like, you know, the funny part of the show, the whipping boy, is what I called it at the time.
Right.
They're missing the whipping boy, someone that they can make fun of and laugh with.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, those guys are both very serious businessmen. They don't want to be the butt of the joke.
Right.
Now everyone's, you know, comfortable with it because we all joke around. So, we always have, but now they're all more comfortable, having a joke made of them on TV.
You become one of the more, I was just
very natural on from the cameras never made me nervous. I think that's one of the main reasons they went with me.
Right.
Mark Davis says community involvement is a high priority with the Las Vegas Raiders.
Any revelations about Las Vegas from you, how the city has surprised you or been turned in some unexpected way now that you've spent some time here?
I'll go back again just to start where you started from was just, you know, that the fact working in the community and how that importance became evident to us was we had moved initially from Oakland to Los Angeles back in 82. And we went down there with one hell of a football team. The first year, there was a strike year, but we ended up in the playoffs and unfortunately didn't win it. But then the following year, our second year in LA, we won the Super Bowl.
Yes, sir.
And my father's mantra was always just win, baby, and that'll take care of it. And although that we worked in the community then, we didn't really get in deep enough and really build something in the community. So just winning is great when you're winning. And, you know, we'd have 93,000 people at the LA Coliseum. But when our record started to fade a little bit and we didn't have the deep, deep connection inside the community, the fan base started to falter.
Right.
And there was a lot of competition there with every different sport and everything else and entertainment and everything. So what I learned at that point in time was just winning wasn't enough, that you had to be a part of a community.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt that if ever we were to build something somewhere, that would be the first thing we would attack, would be getting into the community, letting them know that we care, and showing that we care is more than just talk. And when we came here to Las Vegas, that was the first thing we did.
Right.
And the people here have been so welcoming, and it's so rewarding to give back and pay forward, so to speak, in that, because I think it's going to be a long-term relationship. And I'll say this again, there's a difference between a city that's had a football team or has a football team or has a professional sports team and one that doesn't have one or one that's never had one. And the ones that never had one are so grateful to get one.
Right.
And so it's the beginning of a very good honeymoon right now. And as long as we work together, I can't see anything but greatness.
Davis says he's the devil's advocate in personnel move.
Mike
Mayock is the general manager, and John Gruden is the head coach. They make the decisions on the football side, on personnel and everything. My role that I've made my own role is I'm the devil's advocate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the one who's going to challenge them on every angle of any decision of that magnitude and just test them. And they know they don't need the test, but just to test them and give them questions they might not have thought of or whatever. But the decision is fully theirs.
So if Mike came to you with a plan to maybe trade Derek and before free agency and sign any free agent quarterback, including Brady, would you say?
Well, yeah, I'm not going to make individual comments on any player or anything like that, but sure.
Yeah, you like Derek.
It's up to Mike and John.
And Mark, tell us about your hairstyle.
does your haircut have a name? And what is the story behind it?
No, just I've had the same haircut for the last 20 years, 30 years.
There's none under.
And it's just I'm just losing hair. That's all. You know, so it gets shorter and shorter.
Oh, it's not a toupee.
Not a toupee, man. That's my real deal.
What's the story behind it?
Just the way I get a cut.
You're not going to get a cut to a different style? Part in the middle?
Why?
No, part on the side?
I'm fine with it.
Yeah? Wash and wear?
I'm the one who has to live with it. Got to deal with it.
The MD. Maybe when my hair grows out, we'll all have MD haircuts.
Yeah, you never know.
That closes out part two of Podcats 100. Coming up next is part three of our four-part series. You can catch that at reviewjournal.com and also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Keep up with me, or try to, on the Review Journal website, at Johnny Katz on Twitter, at Johnny Katz 1 on Instagram, and tune in to the next installment of Podcats. Well, it's a jungle out there, baby, but I'm the biggest cat in town.